I will speak about one aspect of a subject that has been around for a few years where there has been considerable controversy in which I got interested not so much because there was a controversy, but because it has some aspects which I found of interest for positive, not negative reason. It connects with some questions in cosmology, and that I will not have time to seriously discuss today. But it also connects with a problem with several problems in turbulence, which I like very much, namely with the problem of what's the role of singularities and how can you detect them and such things. Let me begin here. Let's see, everything is visible, yes. So there are actually three papers which were produced by our group in Nice. They are listed here. You can find them all on the web. It's just that the last one, which is at the core of my present talk, has been revised, and so if you really you want to see the latest version, you ask me. I still have two copies with me. So it's about what we call in our jargon Bergelands. Physical Review does not accept that word, but okay. It's multidimensional. Although controversy started actually in one dimension. Now, you probably know that Berger's equation in one and several dimensions is not just a dead curiosity invented in the 30s because somebody thought that it would be a useful model of Navier-Stokes, and then in the 50s people realized that they could integrate it, and then lots of people thought that it was dead. But the animal refuses to die for a number of reasons. One of them is that it turns out there are quite many problems in physics, particularly in condensed matter physics, which are governed by some variant of the Berger's equation, often the multidimensional Berger's equation. It has a number of interesting applications in cosmology. For example, since I have no time to talk about cosmology, just show you two pictures. Where are they? Things, nice pictures. Yeah. This is the famous Great Wall that is found by observing in Catalogue of Galaxy, and this is a reasonably state-of-the-art simulation where you see lots of structure. It's actually a three-dimensional simulation that's a cut through it. Unfortunately, I do not have the time to talk about the cosmological aspects today. I want to concentrate on things that connect with turbulence. So let me continue the list. There is actually at the end I will point out why some of the results obtained for this Berger's thing could suggest some interesting things for Navier-Stokes. There is one important aspect to all these studies is that it turns out, and you will see in a moment why, that the Berger's equation, particularly when you have a force, is not an easy problem. And there are many questions that are not solved yet. So people have tried all kinds of tools that include field theoretical tools and geometrical tools, statistical tools, etc. And generally what they had in mind is they wanted to try them on Berger's equation to see what they get and then possibly transfer the acquired knowledge and try it on Navier-Stokes. So it is rather important to know if one can find some defects of these methods. So a large number of people have been involved in studying various aspects of virulence, and what I listed here is a very incomplete list. Actually, there are at least two more people who are sitting in this room, Victor Yachot and Baldirev. What's the first name of Baldirev? Asa Stanislav, yeah, like Stan Ulam, of course. Yeah. So let me concentrate on the question which had the original, say, controversy. They are nice people, so they didn't fight each other, but they had different predictions. About 4 years ago, Srini, with others, was organizing a workshop in Princeton, and we had presentations by Polyakov and by Sinai about the same problem, and they had different answers. What is it? Well, you take the one-dimensional version of this, this is Olreberger's equation, and you're asking for the PDF of velocity gradients, the left tail, large negative values. Now, everybody agreed that it is a power law, the tail. So if you denote the value of the gradient by psi, for large negative psi, so it's like psi to the minus alpha, but the value of the exponent, oh, they had a number of different values ranging from 2 to 7/2, depending on which theory you took. What I forgot to say, and what's most important, is that they were all considering the case where there was a force, just so that it resembles some of the problems that theoreticians like to do for Navier-Stokes, and it was a large-scale force in order not to directly generate small-scale stuff by the force, but by some cascade, shocks, etc. This force in all these theories was a large-scale force, which smooth in space, random, of course, but delta-correlated in time for probably theoretical convenience more than anything else. So, that's finished. So the first thing I want to point out is that there is a simpler version of this problem which one can hope to solve. Maybe you remove the force. I mean, everybody knows that for Navier-Stokes, turbulence, having or not having a force doesn't prevent you from having an inertial range, for example. It's just that eventually the thing decays. Same for virulence. You can take a random initial condition, also large scale, so mathematically you would call them smooth, and then ask about the distribution of velocity gradient, the same question that they were asking. Of course, you will get a time-dependent answer, but hopefully, if there is some scaling property, the exponent will not be time-dependent, and it isn't. Now, when you think about this problem, immediately you say, well, okay, for Berger's equation, the answer will be very easy. We know that Berger's, that most of the questions that we used to ask about Berger's turbulence that are somewhat similar to the question that we like to ask in the past about Navier-Stokes turbulence, I mean structure functions, and so on. They are dominated by shocks. So everything will be, we think, dominated by shocks, and it will be boring. This is not the case. As we move from structure functions to PDF, very different objects will come into play. Actually, for Berger's case, the shocks are not giving any contribution to the left tail of the PDF for a very simple reason. If you take a shock in the limit of vanishing viscosity, which is a well-defined concept for Berger's, it's still debatable for Navier-Stokes, but there's no problem for Berger's, a shock is a discontinuity. So you have a negative jump. If you calculate the velocity gradient, you find it's a negative delta function, so it's infinite negative. But now if you're asking, we observe large but finite negative gradients, you will certainly observe an inside shock if you put viscosity, but if you let the viscosity go to zero, it's not there. It's not even at the edges of shock, because typically you enter and you exit a shock with a finite slope. So the places in one dimension where one gets large gradients is when a shock is born. This is called a pre-shock. This kind of structure, if you represent it in a Lyurian coordinate, just before a shock is born, you have some fast particle, fluid particle, which is about to catch up with slow one, and you get the cubic root structure. And such a cubic root structure has very large negative gradients associated to it. So these are the singularities which will give, in one dimension, for the simplest case, will give the dominant contribution to this. This is also what was proposed in the original the paper of et al. was presented by Yasha Sinai 4 years ago at that meeting, and he proposed that pre-shocks should be give the dominant contribution. We don't know exactly what the answer is for the fourth case, but we know definitely for the decaying case that this is correct. And it's quite easy to understand it. It is convenient, not absolutely necessary, to go to Lagrangian coordinates to understand such a thing. So what you do is you define the Lagrangian map, the usual notation, A is the initial position and X is the position at time t. Now everybody knows that in Burger's decaying, no force, a fluid particle, until it enters a shock, just keeps its velocity. So the Lagrangian map is quite trivial. It's A plus t u0 of A. For particles which have not entered shocks, you can then calculate the velocity gradient. You can just evaluate it in Lagrangian coordinates just by changing variables. It's a trivial thing also. And you will see that the dominant effect to get large gradient is to have a small Jacobian. And that is precisely the signature of Nassen shocks. The Jacobian vanishes exactly when a shock is born. But you also know that you have to be careful with Burger's equation, because there are shocks, and if you do things without too much scruple, you will get multi-valued solutions and such junk. Now, how does one do that? If this is the Lagrangian map after a short time before particles did catch up, it looks like that, but if you wait more time, it may look like this, and it's not invertible. Anybody who has studied anything about the Burger's equation knows that there is a Maxwell rule to cut through there with equal areas, and that gives you the position of the shock. That is well known. What is not so well known is that there is another construction which is in one dimension equivalent to that, but which is the only decent generalization to multidimensional case, which is obtained by a convex hull construction. You define a Lagrangian potential the following way. The initial velocity derives from a potential, which is denoted psi zero. So you add this parabolic term. And then, just by taking the gradient, the minus, the negative gradient of this, you will immediately see that you will get the Lagrangian map A plus T U0 of A, which is called the naive Lagrangian map, because it may become incorrect after a while. What is happening is that for short times, this function is dominated by this term, this concave parabola or convex, depending on how you define convexity and concavity, and the whole curve will therefore be convex. But after a while, it ceases to be convex. It will, for example, look like this. And the recipe for doing it right is to take the convex hull. You pull a string around this thing tightly, and there are places where it will jump in straight segments like this. And it's very easy to prove that if you take a new function, which is the convex hull of pi, so the one shown here, its negative gradient will be the correct Lagrangian map and it's an elementary exercise to check that this is equivalent, if you have only one or a few shocks, that is equivalent to Maxwell rule. Hmm? But that can be justified directly without going through the Maxwell rule. I'm just stating it. It's relatively elementary. Now, in order to understand what the contribution of pre-shocks is to the PDF, one uses a very familiar technique in nonlinear dynamics. That one writes a normal form. One writes the local Taylor expansion of the animal on which one will then study near the birth of a shock. This normal form for the Lagrangian potential, as I defined previously, is easily shown to be a combination of a quadratic in Lagrangian coordinates, a quadratic and a quartic term. Tau is a normalized version of the time difference between the presence of time and the time of the pre-shock. And A is taken at the position where the pre-shock will occur. You have to go to by a Galilean transformation to go to a suitable frame so that the place does not move. I mean, these are boring details. And if you look at the graph of this phi for different times, before it has a parabolic maximum, at the time of pre-shock, it's a very flat maximum, it's quartic, and after it, it has these two humps. And when you take the convex hull, then it starts immediately there. This is the shock interval that grows. Its amplitude is easily shown to grow like the square root of t minus t star. It's well known. Now, using such things and doing some relatively simple analysis, which I don't want to go into detail, you can read about it in the papers, you can then find what the probability distribution of negative gradients is. You can do it very thoroughly, systematically with machinery, but you can then also simplify the derivation into a hand-waving derivation, but a hand-waving where you know there is solid stuff behind. And the hand-waving essentially is to calculate what fraction of Eulerian space-time is occupied by gradients which are in excess of a given negative value in absolute value psi. Hmm? And just using this form, it's quite easy to show that the spatial contribution gives a psi to the minus 3 half. It comes from the cubic root structure, and the temporal gives a 1 of psi. Together, they give a psi minus 1, minus 5 half, which is then going to be the probability that a gradient in absolute value is larger than this. So it's a so-called cumulative distribution. The PDF is then minus 7 half. So that's not so new, because this is basically confirming the intuition of Hanin, Mazel, and Sinai, although they were working on the forced case. Now, what's interesting is that the same argument applies to the density. If you have assume that initially you have a distribution of mass, which could be uniform initially, since we are in a compressible, highly compressible fluid, the mass will concentrate, not stay uniform, get a non-trivial distribution of mass. Obviously, the mass is the evolution of the mass is controlled by the Jacobian, because conservation of mass tells you that the density is just the inverse of the Jacobian. And since it's also the Jacobian which controls the large gradients, as you have seen before, you will not be surprised if I tell you that the density also satisfies this minus 7 half law, of course now at large positive values. The density does not go negative. Yes, it is. That's the end of the one-dimensional stuff. Now, what happens to this when you go to several dimensions? At the beginning of if you just look at the algebraic aspects, they look almost identical to what I've presented in one dimension. You now write the d-dimensional Burgers equation. You have the equation of continuity for the mass. you can also investigate the gradients, but the gradients are tensors, so then you have to worry about components, whereas the densities is a scalar. So let's concentrate on the density, and also it's the density that has the interesting cosmological applications. So the density is obviously the initial density, which can assume uniform, divided by the Jacobian. The naive Lagrangian map is just almost the same as in one dimension, just that the initial position is now denoted by vector q. In cosmology, Lagrangian coordinates are denoted by q, not by a, because a has a completely different meaning. Has to do with the expansion of the universe. And everything is identical to what I told you. Yeah? You have to take the convex hull of this Lagrangian potential. The interesting game begins when you look at picture. I'm not talking about simulation. I'm talking about representing what it is to do a convex hull in two dimension. If you have a two-dimensional function, and it's smooth, as we assume in this work, it's some kind of hilly landscape, and now you take the convex hull, which means that you're taking now some elastic and pulling it tightly around it, then generically what you get is this. You get pieces of the original surface, you get triangles, you get things that are generated by segments going over from one edge to the other. They are called by definition ruled surfaces. And you get these points where these things disappear, which you will see are all important, which we nearly forgot. Where was that? I believe 7 or 8 years ago, when we were interested in another problem for which these points are not important. We forgot them because we didn't care about them. And Arnold pointed out, oh, but there is this point there. Okay, so we included it in the paper, but in which we were not calculating the density, so it did not matter. But we're glad we included it, because you will see that's where all the action is taking place. I'll come back to these points in a moment. Now that's a Lagrangian picture. The Eulerian picture is actually dual to that. It corresponds to the orientations of the tangent planes at the various places here, and it's drawn here. In two dimension, instead of getting discontinuities along at points, you get them along lines. These lines meet in triples at nodes. Node is a point. I mean, it's not a fat thing. I'm just shown here. And shock lines may go to another node, or they may terminate abruptly. And you will see it's those termination points which will be very important. You can already smell it. Suppose you are approaching a shock from here, and you are a very tiny animal, not able to look a fly. Things will look very smooth until poof, all of a sudden you fall in the shock. It's like approaching some of these canyons that you see from the airplane over Arizona. So. There's no warning. And if you calculate the Taylor series here in space, it may have a big radius convergence. It will give you no warning that you're about to fall in a shock. There are no large gradients. There's nothing. Very nice, smooth mesa landscape. Not so if you're approaching it from here. You have steep gradients there. Let's look at this more seriously. The first thing that seems to occur is, can we not in two dimension play the same game as in one dimension, namely look at the birth of a shock, a pre-shock? This is what it looks like. Of course, now I'm not going to show you the pre-shock structure at three different times. I'm showing it to you at a time which is just after the birth of the first shocks. It looks like this. It's a two-dimensional version of what we saw before. This thing is going to be parabolic in one direction and quartic or nearly quartic in the other. And just before this concave insert was not present. It's born at the time of pre-shock. Now look here. This structure can be represented by equations. I will show you the equation in just a moment, but you can think of it geometrically, that is perhaps better. You can ask, where does the Jacobian vanish? It turns out geometrically the Jacobian here is literally the same thing as the Hessian of the surface shown there. You know, the Hessian is the determinant of the form that gives you the deviation between the tangent plane and the surface, which is when you expand to second order. So vanishing Jacobian is equivalent to vanishing Hessian, and vanishing Hessian means that you have a parabolic point. A parabolic point is a point on the surface where you have degenerate behavior. The quadratic form has one vanishing eigenvalue. So this dotted line. But now, since you have to take the convex hull to construct the proper Lagrangian map, the convex hull will be made of a ruled surface which attaches along the black line. And most of this dotted line will just be completely irrelevant. It is hidden by the under the convex hull, except at two points, A and A prime, where they touch. And you will see they correspond to endpoints of shocks.
Yes, down, up.
And put this behind so that it doesn't interfere with the microphone. All right, you can still hear me, or speak up now. If you magnify in the neighborhood of such a point, it will look like this. We're zooming into the Lagrangian picture near a point where the line of vanishing Hessian or Jacobian is tangent to the separatrix of the convex hull. Now this point we decided to call kurtoparabolic. There's a very good reason, but that's a new name. In Greek, kurtos means convex. The modern concept of convexity was fully present at the time of the ancient Greeks. They're very good geometers, so they have this word. Why is it kurtoparabolic? Because first it's a parabolic point, the Hessian vanishes, but it belongs to the convex hull, actually to the edge of the convex hull. And this is where all the action comes from. It's those points, and these are the only ones that have large but finite densities or velocity gradients. So you have to represent this surface in the neighborhood of this kurtoparabolic point to find what's going on. And then, of course, well, at some point you have to use normal form theory again. In two dimensions, and in more than two dimensions, they look a bit more frightening. This is normal form of Lagrangian potential. Now you see it has quartic terms and all these things. And one has to expand and find the convex hull and do all these things. But it is not that difficult. The key thing here is the following, that if you look at this Taylor expansion, at the point where here, it's the lower one, yes. Okay, I will just look at the kurtoparabolic one. At the kurtoparabolic point, because it's parabolic, one of the eigenvalues vanishes, so if you take suitable coordinates, the quadratic form will have, say, only a b-square, no h-square term. I'm using a, b for the two components of the Lagrangian coordinates. But if you then look at the cubic terms, generally you'll have a term that is cubic in a, and if this is non-vanishing, it is easy to show that the surface will cross its tangent plane at this point. Because depending on whether A is positive or negative, you will be on one side or the other. That is not consistent with the point being on the convex hull. If you are on the convex hull, you have to be entirely on one side of the tangent plane. Therefore, this coefficient must vanish. So you see, you have two conditions, conditions of parabolicity and condition of being on the convex hull, which is the vanishing of this thing. It's not quite the same thing. No, you will see. So you have a problem with two conditions. This is called the problem of codimension 2. Now, codimension 2, since we are at any fixed instant of time, we are in three space. We are still two-dimensional, two-space. We will get discrete points. They are the contraparabolic points that I showed. They will generally be time persistent. Once shocks are born, the endpoints of shocks will persist. They will move until the shock becomes long enough to attach to another node. But then you may have other shocks born also with such. So they are not discrete in time. They persist in time, contrary to pre-shocks, which appear at a certain instant, they immediately disappear. But the amusing thing is that when you do the calculation of the contribution of such a point to the distribution of density, and do all the averaging, because the problem is probabilistic, but first you have to do the geometry, normal forms, and then the averaging, various sets which look complex but aren't really complex. I mean, the key thing is the geometry. When you do that, once all the dust has settled, you get, it's upside down, but it doesn't matter, you get the same law as in one dimension, a -7/2 law. And the reason is rather curious. It doesn't come now from pre-shocks, it comes from endpoints of shocks, but look at this surface. Imagine that you take cuts for various values of B by planes parallel to the phi A plane. The picture that you will see will be geometrically the same as the one I showed you in one dimension, except that what is now playing the role of the temporal control parameter is a space variable. It's the distance along the shock line, depending on whether you are beyond or before the endpoint. But the expansion is just the same, and all the algebra is essentially the same, except you have to change from time to space, and it comes out exactly like this. Now, in more than two dimension, it is more difficult to represent these things, but the picture is again the same. For a while, we thought that it was changing in three dimension, because we made a mistake concerning the codimension of symmetrical matrices having two vanishing eigenvalues. We thought it is two, it's actually three. This is not trivial. As a consequence, I can tell you that the same picture persists in three, not the picture, the same result. Picture is not easy to draw. It persists in three dimension and almost certainly beyond, so that we have this nice universal. Actually, I'm coming to my last transparency. First, summarize, so very simple, the probability distribution of the density with the assumption we put in, so unforced, in any dimension seems to be rho to the -7/2, quite simple, although the geometry is rather different in one and in several dimensions. There are other terms which can come into it, because you have lots of singularities, particularly in high dimensions. But they probably give, most of them give subleading contributions, so corrections. Sometimes you find that singularities give the same contribution as the leading one, so you have to count them, but they don't change the scaling. So it's a little bit delicate. It resembles a little bit the game that Michael Berry calls the Battle of Catastrophes. Now, the lessons for three-dimensional turbulence, because that's what I want to come to is a very simple one. Whenever you have singularities of the same kind as what we were discussing here, singularities which give you a warning, singularities where when you approach them, some derivatives start growing, not abrupt changes. So these kinds of singularity almost unavoidably will give you a signature in the PDF of, I would say, any derivative, space or time. Of course, if viscosity is present, this may be smoothed, so that you will get it only as intermediate asymptotics, you will get a power law. But what is should worry us is that so far, no decent experiment, there are plenty of decent experimenters in this room, has seen a PDF of a derivative of velocity that displays any significant power law. Now, maybe one has to refine the measurements. Eventually, power laws will emerge. I cannot rule that out. But there's an interesting observation is that as soon as you have singularities, including singularities which are smoothed by viscosity, you should see power laws. And if you don't see power laws in such PDFs, you may just not have any singularities. The converse is not true. There are all kinds of documented mechanisms which can give you power laws without singularities. But singularities, except discontinuities, which are very special, do give you power laws in PDFs. So I would not conclude from this that there are no singularities in viscosity smooth singularity in turbulence, but perhaps just to give you an additional message, I mean, it is worth trying to improve, to push the measurements of PDFs of derivatives, time or space, as far as we can, just to see if we can really rule it out. So that was the message. It's very simple, because once you have located singularities, it's a very simple counting thing that gives you the PDF. You just have to find what fraction of space has a gradient or whatever quantity you have, which is larger than a given threshold. And if you have a power, if you have a singularity, it will be a power law. And then you have to count the codimension of the set that will change you the index of the power law, but it will still give you a power law. They're almost unavoidable.
Recording as many data as possible so as statistical convergence to ensure the achieve. And the larger file includes about 10 to the power 10 data points, samples at the chronological world scale. Do you suggest to go much beyond that?
It is hard to answer that, because depending on the nature and the exponent and the codimension of the singularity, the constraints are very different. This is one of the things we learned by studying Berglund's. Actually, it is in numerical simulation, in order to see these power laws, you have to work really hard. You can easily see spurious power laws also. So I'm not able to answer. What worries me is, I mean, you have these worms that everybody talks about and sees. Now, they could be candidates for singularities. They would just have exponent minus one by Biot-Savart. But they may be animals which disappear completely as the viscosity goes to zero. in which case they wouldn't be singularities of the kind that we're talking about. And there were a number of attempts, including by, I think, Shi Yi. Who is Shi Yi? Floating. No, not Shi Yi. Zensu. Sorry. Yeah. Zensu, some years ago, when he worked with Levesque on the now famous Schur-Levesque model, was in part motivated by filamentary singularity of codimension 2. And you probably remember lots of people tried to cook up models that would give you intermittency correction based on this. But now, if you literally take a filament with exponent minus 1 of singularity on a set of codimension 2 and you try to calculate what that should give for structure function, you get complete garbage. PDFs are different animals. Many of us, including myself with Alain Houlet, etc., we have seen rare, strong events, which are probably the signature of worms, but we haven't seen any scaling associated to them. But you see, if these events begin rather far out in the tail, maybe one has to go beyond. I mean, one has to go, if the last points one sees, the last reliable points one sees are the beginning of the signature of these things, maybe one has to go significantly beyond to possibly see Paolo. But then, I must also warn you that viscosity also gives Paolos, and there are different Paolos. For example, in Berger's turbulence, Goto, who's everybody's here, and Kraiknan, who unfortunately is not here, showed that you get a Paolo with exponent minus 1, but which disappears as the viscosity goes to 0. So the worms also have an internal viscous structure which could possibly give a Paolo contribution, but not the one that has to do with, okay. So cannot directly answer your question.
Two quick questions.
Just a comment. I noticed you mentioned the density Hessian, and I have been looking at gravitational surface formation, and definitely brings you back to the most interesting quantity with respect to the point of zero gradient in density field.
Mm-hmm.
The gravitational surface function, it's almost as though you have turbulent mixing with a negative viscosity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm nothing against negative viscosity.
Okay, the last one.
I do agree that the surface equation itself is very interesting, but on the other hand, we have to the surface equation, like to your comment. I know that the incompletive fluid is different from those equations. Even for compressive fluid, the equation right now is quite different from those equations. Can you comment on that, maybe? What we can learn from Berger's equation, so I think inside you probably are reading.
I mean, all I have seen so far is that they are very different. One thing that upset me particularly is that over the last 4 years or so, a number of hard results were obtained, including by people who are again in this room, concerning the scaling of structure functions for passive scalars. And they were not just waving their hands, they were doing real theory. And they got these exponents, and their theory is not using any singularity. There are the questions of explosive separation of particles, which you can think of as a singularity, but certainly there are no places in space where the field goes singular, except there are these cliffs, ramps or cliffs, where the passive scalar abruptly changes its value and which probably have a fractal structure, which do give a signature for high-order structure function. That's solidly documented. But except for that, no singularity is responsible.
But it is still not Navier-Stokes.
It is not Navier-Stokes, that is true. It's linear, that is true. But in the Navier-Stokes business, I love singularities. I've tried to detect the finite time blow up of the of the Euler equation like everybody else in this room, etc. But we have among the quantities that we like to measure, structure functions, PDF, etc., we have so far not seen anything that forces us to accept singularities. I mean, there are perhaps aborted singularities, but that's a different thing. Hmm?
Okay, yeah? Go ahead.
Oh, I mean, it's... Okay. Thank you, Mr.